From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, what the insurance industry could do to smooth the path of healthcare reform. Later, Scott Russell Sanders has taught young writers for years with one key lesson at the heart.
The kind of writing I enjoy reading and the kind of writing I encourage my students to do is writing where you're actually discovering things about your experience, about the world, about language, about reality.
Then, what's drawing younger people to become farmers in Wisconsin?
I grew up in Milwaukee and my family lives there, and so I want to be feeding the people I know and love, and this is the way I know how.
And a traditional art form is updated in modern quilting. Lake Effect comes your way next, after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Great to have you listening today. The rollout of the Affordable Care Act has been beset by difficulties at a number of levels. Just yesterday, a survey revealed only about half of uninsured adults has even investigated getting insurance through health exchanges. And that comes on the heels of the website troubles as those health exchanges were launched late last year. And in the middle of all of this is the insurance industry, which is now being told to do much of its business in a new way. For a second straight year, the UW-Milwaukee College of Health Sciences is convening a leadership healthcare forum to discuss healthcare reform, this year with an emphasis on the insurance industry. Dr. Chukwuka Enwemeka is the dean of the College of Health Sciences. He's with us in the studio. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
What is the central question you are hoping this upcoming health leadership forum will address?
Well, basically, this is the second in the series on healthcare reform. And as you know, there's so much misinterpretation, misunderstanding, and everybody has a spin on what healthcare reform is. The Affordable Care Act, when it was enacted, all of a sudden became Obamacare. So some people don't even know the real name of this, let alone know what is contained in more than 2,000 pages of the law itself. So we are hoping this time to focus on what the insurance industry should be doing now. Last year, we focused on what the healthcare industry should be doing. This time, it is focused on what the insurance industry should be doing. Because as you know, the act itself mandates the establishment of insurance exchanges. And some states have embraced that. Some have said, no, they're going to set up their own and so on and so forth. So there's a whole lot of confusion involved. And this forum is intended to clarify the air and make things clearer to the general public and to everybody involved.
As an academic center, do you look at the Affordable Care Act as it's playing out in Wisconsin, which has elected not to set up its own exchanges? Is it a laboratory in some ways?
In some ways, yes. And, you know, Wisconsin is not alone. There are some other states that have also declined to participate in this. They're going to set up their own. And as you know, some of the states have also had issues with the software and people logging on and having difficulties and all that. In my opinion, these are teething problems that will disappear over time, and then eventually everything will, you know, straighten itself out and things will start running smoothly, both for the states that are participating and those that are not participating.
It's an interesting comparison to think of the state of the Affordable Care Act today as kind of teething pains.
Yes. I think that's what it is because, as you know, the Federal Insurance Exchange website had some glitches on it. And they've worked out most of those glitches now. And there's still some difficulties, some people having difficulties to log on. But I think over time that will ease out and things will start running smoothly. And it becomes an everyday type of thing.
The model that the Affordable Care Act follows is really seemingly a hybrid of many other plans. It has elements of what's in place in Massachusetts. It has elements of healthcare systems in other countries as well. But it is, as it stands, kind of going into uncharted waters, is it not?
This is correct. This is one of the reasons it was very difficult for Congress to pass this act, because we've never done this before. And in fact, previous attempts to enact this type of act failed woefully. And so we are moving into territories that we've never been before. So we're likely going to encounter things that we are not used to, and we have to work it out. And some people are calling for a repeal of the act itself. So we don't even know how far forward we're going to, you know, be going in this regard. But it's all totally new to all of us.
There seems like an implication in the question of what the insurance industry should be doing, that it isn't necessarily doing what it could be doing or should be doing today. Is that reading too much into the form?
I'll say yes. We are not saying that the insurance industry is not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Everybody is doing something to embrace this change. And what each person is doing or each organization is doing is maybe different from one another. And as we said earlier on, this is uncharted waters. So we really don't know how to deal with it. So if we bring people together with the experts we have on the panel who are going to be addressing this topic, it clarifies the issue. It makes it easier for everybody to understand what they should be doing, and then they get a sense of where things are going, and then they plan better.
Who's likely to call the shots as far as what the insurance industry should be doing? We're in a position where the insurance industry now finds itself working at the bidding of shareholders, but also at the bidding of government entities.
I think everybody will be involved. They will be charting their waters at the bidding of shareholders, the regulators, the consumers themselves, and the third-party payers. I mean, everybody will influence how things will evolve. And again, it is uncharted waters. This is one of the reasons it is so important for us, a College of Health Sciences in a public university, to be heavily involved in educating the public. And we're delighted that we're in a position to do so.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the consumers, because one aspect of the equation that we hadn't addressed yet is where the patients fall in all of this.
Yes. See, this is the thing, that the Affordable Care Act, one of the intentions is to make sure that everybody is covered, that no American will live without health insurance coverage of some sort. And as you know, today, we have about 45 million people that are not covered by health insurance. And that estimate goes even as high as 50 million people. That's about the population of all of Spain, not covered. I don't know that we can afford to do that. Because if someone coughs some disease in some neighborhood far away from you, before you know it, it's probably over in your own neighborhood. So we can't afford not to cover everybody. And we need to make it easier for people to seek health care when they really need health care. And even those who are covered, as you know, many of them cannot afford the copay before now. And many of them are denied certain coverages, even though they have insurance coverage of some sort. And this makes them reluctant to use the healthcare system.
And at the same time, there have been glitches along the way with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act that people who previously had coverage are being dropped.
This is correct. One of the unforeseen consequences of untested waters, you know. So we've now seen a situation where some people are being dropped. And now we have to react, and I guess the system has to react and find a way to deal with it.
Presumably, the leaders of all the nation's insurance companies are all going to be in attendance at this forum. So who do you think stands to benefit most from hearing this discussion?
I think it is those who are involved in the health insurance industry. Every healthcare organization in our region will benefit immensely from this. Every healthcare executive will benefit immensely from this. The healthcare attorneys and lawyers will also benefit immensely from this. Because if you look at the people on the panel, I'll just give you a few names here. Our invited speakers, Kathleen Falk, who is very well known here in Wisconsin. She's now regional director for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She's going to be coming in as an invited speaker. And we've paired her up with Dan Schwarzer, who is the deputy insurance commissioner for Wisconsin. So you have the insurance commissioner giving the insurance commission perspective, state perspective, local perspective, and then we have Kathleen Falk giving the federal perspective on this whole issue.
Which are likely to be fairly divergent
viewpoints.
They may
be a little bit divergent. So then we have a panel that will now discuss the topic following their 20-minute presentations or so. And so on the panel, we have John Torinos. Everybody knows John Torinos in this area. He's one of the people that have been pushing the envelope as far as healthcare insurance coverage is concerned. He's the chairman of Serigraph. We have Bob DeVita. Bob DeVita is CEO of Common Grounds. Common Grounds is a cooperative, a healthcare cooperative of some sort. This is a whole new approach. You know, that we never thought of doing before. So they are there, you know, testing the waters. Then we have Dr. Jean Gilchrist, who is the president and CEO of Milwaukee Regional Medical Center here, the biggest medical center in the complex in the state. And then we have attorney Tracy Klein, who is involved in the legal issues concerning healthcare, insurance coverage, and all the issues related to that. So this is a very high-profile panel that will be addressing this topic, and I think a whole lot of people will benefit from this.
I think when most people imagine the College of Health Sciences, they might not appreciate that part of what you're doing, part of the mission, is educating people in the business of health.
Yes, you're right. Everybody thinks we're there just to train students, award degrees, and so on and so forth. But a good portion of what we do in the College of Health Sciences actually is partnership, partnering with community organizations, partnering with the healthcare industry, partnering with the insurance industry, and so on. If you were to see the advisory board of the College of Health Sciences, it is actually a mix of everybody from every walk of life in our community. And we have a whole lot of community outreach programs that we engage in, not just teaching and, you know, giving lectures, continuing education programs, and then doing distance e-learning and so on. But we have actual services going on within our southeastern Wisconsin region and even beyond. So we are heavily involved in community services.
What would you want people to do with what they get out of this forum? Once they leave the forum itself, what are you hoping that they take with them?
What we're hoping that they take with them is a clearer understanding of the Affordable Care Act, clearer understanding of it that then empowers them and enables them to act in the proper manner to move this forward. They become enlightened, and then they have a better perspective of where things are going in the future. And then they're better prepared to deal with the issues that will be coming down the pike.
Do you think people on both sides have open enough minds when it comes to the Affordable Care Act?
This is very interesting. So one of the things we think we're going to do with this whole thing is hopefully the enlightenment, helps people to get a better perspective of how the other person is thinking about this. And then they get a sense of where they are. And hopefully they'll meet at a common ground and then, have a better understanding and better interaction going forward.
It has not always been a rational, measured debate when it comes to health coverage.
Not really. This is so interesting. I give the example that when the ADA was passed, the same debates went on. People fought vehemently on both sides. We can't afford this, we can't do this, and da, 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 da. Now it is part of everyday life. And if you go back to Medicare, Medicaid, it's taken for granted. But you know what? Medicare, Medicaid takes a big chunk of the federal government spending, almost as much as Social Security. Social Security takes about 22%, Medicare, Medicaid, 21%. And guess what? People are not complaining about it because they've gotten so used to it.
Well, Chukwuka Enwemeka, thank you so much. I appreciate your rational and measured discussion here.
Mitch, thank you very much for having me on this program. Thank you.
Chukwuka Enwemeka is the Dean of the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. The college's annual Leadership Healthcare Forum is next Wednesday at the Italian Conference Center in Milwaukee. There is a link to more from wuwm.com/Lake Effect. A conversation with award-winning writer Scott Russell Sanders when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Writer Scott Russell Sanders is loved by many for novels and essays, many of which carry a natural theme. But while the environment does play a significant, vital role in his books, such as A Conservationist Manifesto and his latest, Divine Animal, it's not the only issue he writes about. Sanders' work spans 20 books of fiction and nonfiction, though, as we'll hear, nonfiction isn't a term he especially likes. He's told his own coming-of-age story, he's examined how geography influences culture, and is currently at work on a project exploring the meaning of wealth Along the way, he's collected numerous awards for his writing and also appointments such as the 2014 Lois and Willard Mackey Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at Beloit College, which comes to an end today. It is the second time he's held that post. He spoke earlier this week at Milwaukee's Urban Ecology Center, and he joined us in the studio. Welcome. It's a pleasure to meet you.
I'm happy to be here.
There's a temptation to talk chronologically with you about your work, but I was hoping actually we might start with the present day. You have spent the last couple of months at Beloit as the Lois Mackey Chair in Creative Writing. If a student of yours, you know, whether or not it's in the formal classroom setting, gets no other message from working with you, what do you hope they take?
I think the single most important lesson I've learned from a life in writing is that writing is a way of thinking and writing is a way of discovery. Often in school, as we're growing up, writing is presented to us as a way of packaging knowledge that's already known and then delivering it in a nice, neat fashion to the teacher. You're not really making any discoveries. But the kind of writing I enjoy reading and the kind of writing I encourage my students to do is writing where you're actually discovering things about your experience, about the world, about language, about reality. And so that's the single most important lesson or insight that I would hope they would go away with.
Do you find it's difficult to turn off that need to know exactly where you're going with something and what you're going to reveal, you know, before you set out on the writing journey?
It took me quite a while. And I understand that students might feel very insecure if they're launching out on an inquiry and really don't know where it's going to end up. Obviously, they always have a chance to revise. So once you've ended up somewhere, you can then revise the whole piece to prepare for where you've landed. But it requires an openness to insight, an openness to exploration that we tend not to be taught when we're coming up through school. Again, we tend to be taught in a way where you're finding the certain things, the known things, and you're simply delivering them rather than discovering them.
It's interesting. There is a phenomenon in radio programs like this called the pre-interview that many shows follow, where there's a producer who will call an interview subject and essentially interview that person before the host interviews that person, so that there are no surprises once the interview actually takes place.
There is a major American hotel chain, I won't name the brand, which for some years ran a television advertisement in which a couple traveling, first of all, they come into a lobby where they're strange. People are dressed in strange clothes and strange sounds and creatures, and they decide to leave. And then they go to this chain hotel, and the clerk welcomes them, and the ad says, "No surprises." In other words, this is a place where you know everything before you come. But of course, we don't learn anything if we know everything before we start. We only learn by being open to new discoveries. I've actually had those pre-interview interviews, and so I know what you're talking about. And I always find the actual interview much less interesting if it feels more canned than one where I and the interviewer are really exploring together.
There's this whole field that, you know, maybe I missed it when I was in school, but it seems like maybe the label is a recent development, the idea of so-called creative nonfiction. What are your feelings about that label?
I dislike the label intensely, and you would not have encountered it when you were in school because it's a relatively new term. It has two problems with it. The first is the word creative, and the second word is the word nonfiction. The problem with the word creative is it implies that there are other kinds of writing and other kinds of thought, for that matter, that are not creative. Well, I happen to love science, and my wife's a scientist, my daughter's a scientist, and my undergraduate studies were in science. And science is tremendously creative. Good history requires creative intelligence. A good biography does as well. So I don't distinguish between creative writing and writing that's somehow not creative. So that's the first problem. The bigger problem, however, is nonfiction. That's a term that was coined in the 19th century by librarians to divide their collection between novels and stories on the one hand, and on the other hand, sermons and histories and very serious books. Well, calling all those kinds of writing, nonfiction, is like saying food is divided up between cheese and non-cheese, right? Well, that doesn't help you very much. So that spaghetti is non-cheese and so is pork and so is chocolate. And they're all non-cheese, but that doesn't really tell you anything interesting. So I think the term creative nonfiction is an unfortunate one. I also feel we're stuck with it. So my workshop is in the writing. I have two different ways of describing it. One is personal essays and one is personal narratives. And the personal is an important word. It's to distinguish it from scholarship and journalism. And narrative means storytelling. But this is storytelling where the stories you're telling derive directly from your own experience. You're not making them up, in other words.
Do you think – are we too quick to put things that seem objectively scientific in that box? I guess the question I'm working towards is you said you yourself studied science at first in school. Your wife is a scientist. Your daughter is a scientist. Are we too quick to remove the creativity from science and separate things like science and math from the humanities?
Oh, definitely. My wife, when she would come home from the lab and I would ask her how the experiment was going, she'd say, well, we're getting wonderful data, but we don't have a story yet. And this wasn't unique to her. This is a term that scientists frequently use. And by story, she means, okay, we have these pieces of evidence that we've gathered from our experiment. But the story essentially is the narrative which connects them. And that's what a scientific hypothesis is. And that requires creativity. All of the great scientists have testified to this. Einstein and Galileo and Newton and so forth have talked about the role that imagination plays in science. It's not just a machine where you turn the crank enough times and then out comes some scientific theory. You gather evidence, but then you have to see a pattern, and that requires imagination. So I see good science as being absolutely as creative an endeavor as composing music or painting paintings or writing poetry.
How did you discover the personal essay?
I discovered it as a confirmed fiction writer. All of my early writing for about 15 years was short stories and novels, and I still write fiction. My most recent book is a novel. But when I became a father and spent lots of time with our two young children, I wanted to write about those experiences I was having with them, but I didn't want to fictionalize them. And so I started writing what I thought of simply as true stories. This is something I did yesterday with my son. This is something I did today with my daughter. And those true stories, it turned out, were essays. And I didn't even know they were essays until magazines started publishing them and calling them essays. And I came to write more and more of that personal essay kind of writing as a way of exploring my own experience.
Why didn't you want to fictionalize them?
Well, there are two reasons that I didn't want to fictionalize my experiences with my children, with young children. First of all, it's very difficult to treat children in fiction without sentimentalizing them. And second of all, it would seem to distort or take away from the actual veracity of the experience that I have with my children and now with my grandchildren. So I think there are experiences that lend themselves to fictionalizing, where free invention makes sense. And then there are experiences where you have a respect for the actual experience and you don't want to alter it in the way that fiction would require. So as I say, today I write both. I write fiction and I write essays. And I almost always know at the outset clearly and distinctly which kind of thing I'm writing.
Many of your essays and much of your fiction has an environmental feel to it. Did you consider yourself an environmental writer when you first began writing?
I didn't, no. But I grew up in the country in Ohio, rural Ohio, spent as much time as I could outdoors. And so I've always loved nature. I thought of it as nature. I always loved trees and creeks and rocks and so forth. And so my writing has always been filled with references to the natural world. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s, really. I'm now 68, so it's been a while. But it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I began to see that nature, what we call nature, is endangered. the things that I love, the things that I find beautiful and exciting and that have nourished me all my life are endangered. And because nature's endangered, we're endangered. So that meant in the jargon of our culture that I'm an environmentalist. So I didn't set out to become an environmentalist. It was a way of, it was a consequence of following my fascination with and love of the natural world. What I call myself now, people say, are you a nature writer? And I say, actually, I'm an earth writer. That is, I'm aware of living on a planet alongside about 7 billion of my own species and millions of other species, and depending for everything that I eat and drink and wear and use in my daily life, as do we all, on the earth. So I'm intensely aware of belonging to the natural world.
It seems as though you were coming into your own in this career at a time when maybe the conservation movement was also coming into its own, the Clean Water and the Clean Air Acts, and not long before the first Earth Day. How did the place of the movement in the public eye perhaps affect the writer you were becoming?
Oh, it had a very big effect. I was deeply influenced by several major social movements in the 1960s, because that's when I came of age. I graduated from high school in 1963. I graduated from college in 1967. I finished a PhD in English in 1971. So basically the decade of the 1960s was the decade in which I formed most of my adult concerns and many of my values. And the nascent environmental movement of the 1960s was a major part of that. So was the civil rights movement. So was the women's movement. So was the anti-war movement. So those were the big social public movements that were convulsing our culture in the 1960s and that had a profound influence on me. Listeners today may find it, especially younger listeners, may find it hard to believe that in the 1960s, there was bipartisan support for the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, the Wilderness Act, the Environmental Protection Agency Act. There was a sense that we need to take care of our shared world, the natural world on which we depend. Unfortunately, that consensus has been lost in most of our state legislatures and definitely in the U.S. Congress.
Scott Russell Sanders, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's been a pleasure, Mitch. Thanks for having me on.
Scott Russell Sanders just finished a term as the Mackey Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at Beloit College. He taught from 1971 to 2009 at Indiana University, where he is now a Distinguished Professor Emeritus of English. His latest novel is Divine Animal. It's currently available for free as an ebook. There is a link from wuwm.com/likeeffect. Why are some young Wisconsinites choosing to pursue a career in farming? We'll hear from one farmer when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. It's still hard to imagine life will eventually pop up across our still-frozen landscape, but farmers will assemble at the Urban Ecology Center on Milwaukee's east side tomorrow to remind us that spring will indeed come. Many are young people drawn to the grow local, eat local, community-supported agriculture model. Individuals sign on, pay a fee for the season. In exchange, they receive boxes brimming with fresh-from-the-field produce. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz ran into one of those farmers last weekend out of town in La Crosse at a conference of Midwest organic growers. We learn about one person's evolution from non-vegetable-eating child in Milwaukee to budding farmer who savors nearly everything fresh from her own field.
My name is Anna Metcher. I farm in Fredonia, Wisconsin, and my farm is called Wild Ridge Farm. This is going to be our first season. Last year, Alyssa Moore and I farmed separately our independent projects on the same land and with our third partner, Joseph Dittman, who is not a farmer, but he worked on the property with us, and we decided to combine forces this year.
When did you make your entry into farming?
I started farming in 2010. After I graduated college, I worked on a farm out in Washington State near Seattle, and I fell in love with it, and I've been farming ever since, working on other people's farms. And then last year I had an incubator plot, and now this year I have my own farm.
Where and what did you study?
I went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I have a degree in soil science and a minor in environmental studies.
What took you in that direction?
I don't really know exactly. I grew up a city kid. I didn't really know what I was going to do in college, and I always loved plants. I always loved being outside. And after I graduated with this degree in soil science, I could either go back to school and do a bunch more research, which interested me, or I could just travel and eat. So I ended up traveling. I was on the West Coast and the East Coast and the Midwest working on farms and just learning new recipes and meeting new people and having a really good time, working hard doing that.
So this year you'll have your first CSA?
I had a CSA with my incubator farm last year. I had a 10-member CSA that I ran all by myself on about half an acre. But this year is going to be a bigger endeavor. We're going to do farmers markets and the CSA and also some wholesaling in Milwaukee.
So how many acres are you planting?
We're growing about 4 acres this year.
So describe your spot.
We have a greenhouse, a heated greenhouse, where we start all of our starts. And we also have a hoop house where we're going to grow early and late season crops. We hope to do some wintering of greens, but also early tomatoes. We're near the Milwaukee River, so part of our land is bordered by woods on the Milwaukee River, and we're on this beautiful hilltop, so you can kind of see the valleys around us, and it's a really gorgeous piece of land with silty loam soils.
So how many different vegetables do you grow?
We grow about 35 different kinds of vegetables and many varieties within that. Highly diversified farm.
So how do you come up with the formula of where you're going to sell and how many CSA members you're going to aim for and that sort of thing?
We've been pretty lucky because Alyssa and I have both spent time working in this market, in the Milwaukee market area, so we kind of have a feel for what other farms are doing. We decided this is our first year, we don't want to get too big. We kind of figured out the amount of money we thought we needed for 3 partners and how much food we could reasonably, realistically sell to kind of make that kind of target.
You talked about deciding that traveling and eating and working hard really suited you. What about what you're doing means most to you?
Oh, that is a deep question. I like it. It's easy kind of to answer here at the Moses Conference because there's such a wonderful network of farmers in Wisconsin, and we're so lucky to be a part of that. And it's just so uplifting to have such a resource base at our fingertips where we can share ideas and share resources and share marketing ideas, because I grew up in Milwaukee and my family lives there. And so I want to be feeding the people I know and love, and this is the way I know how.
So what did your parents think of your career move?
They are still shocked. They still say, soil science, what is that? For a while they were supportive, but questioning me. And now that they can come up to the farm, I mean, it's a 30-minute drive away. They can come up and help me weed onions or pick a fresh bouquet of flowers, and then I can cook them dinner, and they can kind of see how happy I am and what we're doing up there. I think they're really impressed.
The fact that you now know what to do with an eggplant.
Exactly, and now I can cook dinner with an eggplant. 4 years ago, I would have never guessed. Could have whipped up a whole meal.
Just in terms of food growing up, what kind of a food palate?
No, I was the pickiest eater. I would eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches cut on a diagonal and like carrots. We did not have, I didn't know a thing about food until I started working on farms. I just refused to try it. And now there's really nothing I won't try it at least twice. I try everything twice.
Anything that is just off the list, just forget it.
I haven't had okra, but we don't grow that, and I don't know if I can handle it. It's kind of slime. I don't really like zucchini and that same, I don't know. I feel like that's a bad answer.
Anna Metcher grows with her 2 partners at Wild Ridge Farm in Fredonia. She spoke with Susan Bentz. Wild Ridge is among the participants at the 12th annual Local Farmer Open House being held at Riverside Park's Urban Ecology Center tomorrow. What is on your agenda for the weekend? If history is any guide, I will be shuttling one or both of my kids to practice at the ice rink. Lake Effect essayist Liam Callanan knows that scene pretty well and says that those of us who are sports parents should enjoy it while it lasts.
In the past 12 months, I've been to one Packers game, one Bucks game, four Brewers games, and roughly, I'm still counting, but this seems right, 147 games that one of my three daughters have played in, or some kind of sporting match roughly every 2.5 days. That seems about right. Or to many people, I know it seems very wrong. It sounds like we have overscheduled our children. The truth is, we've cut back a bit. Swimming and gymnastics and horseback riding have fallen by the wayside. We're now focusing on volleyball and basketball and softball. Oh, and soccer. Oh, and there has been talk of golf and maybe field hockey. Oh, and I'm going to have to wrap this up quickly because I'm late to another game or practice. But I will be there. No matter how many games their schedules throw at me, I go and go and go and go and go because this year I suddenly realized it was going to stop and soon. I came about this realization the way I do most of my wisdom these days, courtesy of my daughters. I have three, 13, 11, and 6. The oldest and self-proclaimed wisest often is, and when I asked her if she really wanted to go out for middle school basketball this year, she said, of course, because given her skill level and height, this would be the last chance she would ever get to play on a school team. And so this would be my last chance to see her in action or sitting on the bench, but still, it hit hard, that discovery, and reminded me of another older dad with his three kids now in college and beyond who told me that he remembered well exhausting weekends of driving back and forth across the city, the Midwest, for one sporting event after another. And he remembered how now that those days were long gone and he now had his weekends all to himself to do whatever he wanted, sleep in, read the entire paper, catch a movie. He missed his parents' spectator days more than ever. So I'm pre-nostalgic. I'm going to miss driving with barely one eye open through dark, empty streets to some far-off gym for an early Saturday morning tip-off. I'm going to miss the ubiquitous Booster Club popcorn, never more than a dollar, always made with a recipe that seems to call for as much, if not more, salt than popcorn. And I'm going to miss yelling. Yes, I am one of those dads. No, I'm not the type who yells at the ref or the opposing team or even our own team if they've done something wrong. I'm very encouraging, and I speak in code. When I think one of my children needs to go faster, I yell, wheels, slang which apparently is so outdated that another parent once asked me why I was yelling it. Was it my daughter's name? It's not, but I have another daughter who is named Honor. And in a story I've told many times, many years passed before I realized that not everyone knew that that was her name, that all, say, opposing teams knew that there was a crazy father on the sidelines or in the stands who eschewed normal cheers like go team for the far more elemental, even primal exhortation, honor, honor. It's gotten now so that Honor will sometimes shout back, fist in the air, glory. I'm going to miss these glory days. The overheated gyms, the early season softball games where the temperature hovers in the high 40s, the bruises and scrapes, the highs, the lows, the victories and losses, the three-point shot sunk, the attempt to steal third foiled. 147 games, and that's just these last 12 months. When I think what I could have done with all that time, I'm glad I did absolutely nothing else. And besides, it's spring. I just signed up my youngest, my 6-year-old, for her very first season of Little League.
When he's not prowling the sidelines, author and Lake Effect essayist Liam Callanan is prowling bookstores. He'll be at Boswell Books tonight to introduce visiting authors Michael Parker and Murray Farish. One last break, and then a new book and exhibit on some crafts that are not your grandmother's quilts. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Quilting often brings up mental images of 19th century women in Appalachian log cabins piecing together scraps of cloth by firelight. Well, tell that to Milwaukee's Lee Heinrich and Chicago's Faith Jones. These two very modern women, along with others around the world, have taken a craft that was born out of necessity and turned it into one that is both utilitarian, you can use your quilts on the bed or sofa, and artistic. They are called modern quilters, and they borrow and interpret classic quilt patterns as well as inventing their own. Heinrich and Jones are co-authors of a recent book on modern quilting called Vintage Quilt Revival, 22 Modern Designs from Classic Blocks. An exhibit on modern quilts is open at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg, and Lake Effect Bonnie North sat down with those two authors at the museum, and Heinrich began by explaining the difference between modern and traditional quilting, which is not as straightforward as you might expect.
If you ask 10 different modern quilters what modern quilting is, you'll probably get 10 different answers. But personally, I feel that modern quilting is very design focused. It uses asymmetry, negative space. A lot of the design concepts that I've always used as a graphic designer in my professional life have kind of been transported to the modern quilting world for me. So I come at it from that perspective, and I think a lot of people in modern quilting kind of come at it from the same perspective.
Faith, for you?
I agree with a lot of Lee. I think you'll see a lot of improvisation, not set grid design, but a lot of maybe floating blocks or not a set block structure or layout. Also, as far as the usability, you won't see a lot of the quilts just hanging up on a wall. They're going to be, you know, used and loved within the home. So that's another big difference, I think.
Talk about how you use negative space in quilting. How does that translate into the fibers?
Well, again, I'm coming at it from a graphic design background because that was my profession for many years. And negative space is such an important part of any kind of design for me. It really gives the eye a place to rest. It kind of sets off the parts of the design that you want to set off. It gives it more impact, more of a graphic effect. So negative space is really very important in modern quilting for all those reasons, I think.
But it's not necessarily, say, dark fabric. It could be, it's just something that doesn't draw your eye.
It's any area that doesn't have a design element, I guess I would say. Any part that is basically the background of the quilt. It can be a print, but usually it's kind of a tone-on-tone print, very subtle. It might just give texture. So there's a variety of ways that negative space can be used.
So how do you both approach quilting? I mean, when you're thinking of a new one to do you start with an idea in mind or do you go with what fabrics you have on hand? How does the process work?
I design first and then I pick the fabric second. And I do a lot of my design work on my computer using a program called Photoshop. But there are, you know, free programs out there. One's called GIMP and you can download it for free online and it's similar to Photoshop where you could just do graph paper. But I spend a lot of my free time just using the drawing tools in Photoshop and playing with lines and the rulers and the tool and seeing how putting different design blocks together, do they create an interesting pattern? And then I just have a folder on my computer full of ideas that I can go to when I want to start something new. So it might just be snippets here and there that work together, or it might just be, you know, one block design I came up with that then I drag some colors into it and say, oh, this is a really neat pattern or secondary patterns. So I do a lot of my work on the computer, and then after that, I'll go to my fabric and say, okay, what would look good here?
And Lee, for you?
I really work primarily the way that Faith does. The one thing I'll add to that is that a lot of times I will go and use a traditional quilt block, you know, decades, hundreds of years old even, as my starting point. But then I think we both have similar styles in that we try to use those traditional blocks kind of in a little bit of a more modern way. And there's a whole variety of ways that we do that. But a lot of times that's my starting point. I'll look through a volume of traditional blocks and find something that I want to use and then go from there.
One of the things that I noticed in the exhibit that was just here, the Japanese exhibit, mm-hmm. is that there was a lot of layering and a lot of applique and a lot of other things that go on. Do you both incorporate that into your work?
No, I don't do a lot of applique, and I don't do a lot of layering. And I don't know if I see a lot of that in the quote modern quilt community?
I would say that's maybe more an art quilting method. I don't think that really is used frequently in modern quilting. Art quilting and modern quilting are something that a lot of people don't quite know the difference between.
I was just going to ask you. I didn't realize that there was a difference.
There is a difference. I would say that, you know, we went to the Chicago Quilt Show this past summer, and this is something I've thought a lot about because I feel like I know the difference between modern quilts and art quilts, but I didn't quite know how to put it into words until we went to the Chicago Quilt Show. And all of a sudden it hit me that, for me anyway, the difference between modern quilts and art quilts is like the difference between art and graphic design. And again, I'm always coming at it from that perspective, but I think art quilters really are creating a piece of art with fabric, whereas quilters are thinking more in terms of design and not like an art composition. So I think that's the difference there, to me anyway.
What about you?
No, I completely agree. We spent a lot of time walking through the show and looking, and I think the Modern Quilt Guild had an exhibit there and kind of doing some comparisons, and there are just so many beautiful quilts at that quilt show, but you could definitely, when you see them in person, see the difference.
And I think modern quilting is really, in a lot of ways, about making a quilt that looks good in a modern home as a throw or a bed quilt or something along those lines, as opposed to a piece of art that you put on the wall.
So there's that practical aspect,
yeah.
You know, a usefulness to it, which is what the original quilts were all about, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have a book. Who are you marketing the book to? Are people like yourselves doing this kind of modern quilting, or perhaps people who may consider doing it? Maybe they're doing more traditional quilting?
I think the beauty of the book is it reaches a big audience. It's for, say, someone who just started quilting, is interested in the modern quilt world, and maybe they've done a lot of improvisation, but they haven't really looked at the history of quilting, kind of the roots, seeing what you can do with these really classic, beautiful blocks. And then you're also, you have maybe someone who's made traditional quilts for years, and they're looking for something new, a fresh new look for their layout, or a new way to use color, or just some new ideas. And I think it's going to attract that that type of quilter as well. So that's one of the things we're most excited about with the book, is that it's really kind of a joke that it's a book that I love, it's a book that my mom loves, and it's a book that my grandmother loves. And I don't know if you can say that for every book out there.
I think we're really trying to bring together the best of both the modern and traditional quilting worlds. I mean, as modern quilters, I think we still have a lot of appreciation for the traditions of the craft. So we're trying to bring that appreciation to modern quilters, but we're also trying to expand the horizons of people who are more traditional.
I think a lot of people, when they think of quilts, if they're not in the world, think of Appalachia. You know, they think of quilts and cabins and that sort of thing. But you were both from the Midwest. Is there a Midwest sensibility to modern quilting? Is there a style that you could point to and say, well, this is particularly Midwestern?
I don't know about that. You know, I might blow your mind. My parents grew up in Orange County, California. My mom's a quilter. So there are quilters everywhere. But, you know, I did grow up in the Midwest, and I feel like it was appreciated here. And that was another, you know, but there's different regions of the country. We just went to Salt Lake City for a conference, and I feel like quilting is extremely appreciated in that town. Mm-hmm. We were in the lobby of a hotel, and everyone was hand-stitching and knitting, and everyone came up to us. What are you guys doing? This is so cool. I mean, all ages. A woman in her wedding dress that was there checking in after her wedding came over and said, I want to be at this conference. What are you guys doing? You know, her poor groom standing over at the other side of the hotel. So I think there are probably some areas in the country, Austin, Texas, which is a really fun, hip town. We just had a modern quilting convention there, QuiltCon, and I feel like that town really appreciated the handmade. So I'm not sure if it's maybe a regional thing or different cities, but as you see knitting taking off and people, you know, making their own clothes taking off, I think handmade is becoming more accepted and more celebrated.
Yeah. Etsy, a lot of people are buying things and making things to sell on Etsy. I think there's been a real resurgence in handmade recently all over. And another thing I'll say is that a big part of the modern quilting movement is being online. and interacting with people, not just in your physical location, but all around the world. So as a result, I think maybe there aren't regional styles anymore like there used to be, because technology has made it so easy for us to interact with people all over. And everyone is kind of getting inspiration from, you know, pictures of quilts online and things like that. So it really kind of expands the influence of the modern quilting movement all over the place.
It's really much more global than, yes. So I was just thinking, would there be designs that you could point to in the modern quilting world that, you know, you might say, oh, that person is from, but it sounds like not. It sounds like it's kind of whatever moves the particular quilter.
Yeah, I think there, some people have personal styles. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I can look at a quilt and say, oh, I know who designed that. That's, you know, Jackie Gehring's quilt or Ashley Newcomb's quilt or something. But there's a lot of different ways that modern quilters are connecting now, some through an app called Instagram on phones, smartphones. And you will see Pinterest, yeah, you will see organic quilt-alongs pop up where someone will start making a certain block, and then all of a sudden you have people from England and Australia and California and Seattle, you know, all these different places making these blocks all at the same time and making these quilts. So,
and posting them,
the pictures on the social media. Mm-hmm. So to see it, just a pattern, you might say, I know where that started, but it really spreads globally immediately.
I love the idea of quilting by Instagram. I think that's just an amazing thing, and what a very modern way to approach a very old craft.
We've talked before about how, you know, in our grandmother's and great-grandmother's days, there were quilting bees, and now people from all over the country and all over the world are making blocks for each other and exchanging, and it's really fun how this very old tradition has just been moved online.
Well, Lee and Faith, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chicago's Faith Jones and Milwaukee's Lee Heinrich, along with Katie Clark Blakesley, are the authors of Vintage Quilt Revival, 22 Modern Designs from Classic Blocks. They spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. The exhibit, Modern Perspectives, runs through April 6th. You'll find a link to more, plus a slideshow of quilts from the book at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. It is a patchwork of people that brings together Lake Effect every week. We are produced by Bonnie North, Dan Harmon, and Stephanie Lecce, with additional production support from Eleanor Peterson and Craig Wirrell. Web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki and his many coils of wire. I'm Mitch Tyke. Don't forget, late Saturday night is the big shift to daylight saving time. You'll lose an hour of sleep, but I promise you, Lake Effect Weekend will be worth losing sleep over. It comes your way Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.